It is my pleasure to introduce your speaker for tonight, Dr. Bill G. from Kernville, Texas.
Good evening, and God bless you. My name's Bill Gambrill, and I'm an alcoholic. That's certainly comforting to be greeted. It's through the grace of a God that I found finally, or at least became aware of, as a result of getting around to taking the steps of the program, that I've been sober now a day at a time since the 31st of December 1968. And for that, I'm very grateful. Probably not as grateful as I ought to be, but I'm as grateful as I can be. To me, my recovery a day at a time is a miracle because I base that recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous against the attempted recovery for so many years using conventional therapy at the hands of my fellow doctors and practitioners. I want to thank Ann for inviting me out here. The speaker last night likened herself, as I got her story, to Gunsmoke from Kansas, which left me horseshit from Texas. This is my first trip to California since 1942. I came to California hiding behind the skirts of patriotism right after the Japanese hit Pearl Harbor. When I say hiding behind the skirts of patriotism, I was not doing too well at home. I was sort of a rebellious youth, as I look back on it. I joined the Air Force as a private, was making $21 a month, and somebody mentioned that off we go into the wild blue yonders, and their uniform looked a lot better than what I was wearing, and they got $75 a month, so I decided I would sign up and see if I could fly the airplanes. And I saw this happen in the Army. I guess all the California aviation cadets went to Texas. At least all the Texas aviation cadets came out to California. I'd been in the service long enough before I came to California to being from Texas, this didn't bother me, but I'd kind of grown used to some kidding by people from New Jersey and Virginia and Georgia and California and other places. That somebody from Texas had sort of a role, at least as I saw it, they told me, a role to uphold. When I arrived in California, I arrived with this role to uphold. I had learned how to drink a little bit after having gone through the puking stage around the age of 14 or 15, playing football and going to dances and loosening myself up a little bit. I'd learned a little bit about drinking back there in Texas. But when I hit California, I had this role to uphold since I was from Texas. And the way I saw my role, I needed to fight better than anybody else. And I could fly those airplanes better than anybody else. And I could make love better than anybody else. And anybody that disagreed with me was in for an argument because I was defending the honor of the state of Texas. Now, none of that could I do nearly as well sober as I could if I had a few drinks. And that's where my personality began to change. I seemed to become a better fighter. I seemed to become a better pilot. I certainly got over my awkwardness and my shyness as far as my courting was concerned. I envisioned myself as a great romanticist as I put that nice uniform on and threw that sash around my collar and the wind blew across, and I liked the girls in California. It seemed to me like that under the influence of alcohol that they were a bit more forward than the... We didn't have haystacks, by the way, back in Texas. I learned to play doctor in a barn. At any rate, I made a splash when I came out here. Ann said that the day that she arrived in town, we came in a day earlier, but that she sent someone to the airport, and they didn't know what I looked like, and I wasn't aware that she sent anyone to the airport. But she was suggesting to the man that she sent to pick me and my wife up at the airport that he would have no trouble recognizing me because I'd be dressed in blue jeans with a cowboy boots on, a wide Stetson hat, and a sheepline fur jacket, and I'd also have a stethoscope around my neck. Well, let me tell you, I eased into this town this time. I didn't come in with any splash. Part of me getting well is to become a bit more humble, and I hope I have been able to do so. At any rate, it's good to be here. It's good to see the young people here. I always keep a weather eye open for that. I have a special place in my heart for the young people back where I come from. I don't know how you feel about it, but I don't believe at the age of 18, 19, 20, 21, I don't believe a soul could have told me I was an alcoholic at that age and made me believe it. And yet I see more and more of them in about that age group coming to our groups in Texas, and at least to look around here, I see some young people here too. And theoretically, the earlier we treat this disease, the less complications we have on down the line. It's good to be here. I am a doctor, but you all will do me a great service tonight if you'll let me just talk to you as Bill Gamble. It's impossible to keep my medical background out of this because it has something to do with my story. But I made the fatal error when I joined Alcoholics Anonymous in 1966 of relying on my vast medical knowledge coupled with the insight that you gave me offering a psychological and psychiatric explanation as to why your program worked and I got drunk. I alluded to the fact I started drinking about the what we call junior high back in Texas. I did it for several reasons, all of which have something to do with my personality. I did it because everybody else did it. It was a sign of growing up. I did it because my mother and father didn't want me to do it. And I don't know whether that still holds true, but it holds true in my three daughters and one son. If I don't want them to do something, I tell them to do it, and vice versa. I did it for another reason, which I think is germane to the disease. It made me feel better. It made me feel different. Now, I'm an alcoholic, and I've been awful sick from this disease, both physically, mentally, spiritually, morally. But I didn't get sick like that all of a sudden. It took a long time. I had a lot of fun with drinking early. It did something for me. It did something to me. It allowed me to change my personality and to become part and parcel of a crowd that I wanted to belong, that I felt on the outside of until I took a few drinks. And the change in me was almost instantaneous. And I suspect, although I don't know, but I think I probably thought at that time that anybody who drinks has this same good, wonderful feeling that I get when I drink. And I had the feeling in relation to my parents that everything that I think is good in life, they're against. And that seemed to work true. No matter what they had told me, they told me not to do all these things, and every time I did one of the things they told me not to do, it made me feel better. Drinking was just one of those things. I was controlled, I suppose. I did pretty well until I did get into the service. Came to California. I made him a good hand in the Air Force. I could fly those airplanes all right. But I had a rebellious streak, and I think most alcoholics have it. Maybe not all, but I certainly had that, and the ones that I talked to that I could relate to, I looked for that. Because I was such a good pilot, I felt that it wasn't necessary for me to follow all the rules and regulations that the Army had set up for us cadets, especially those having to do with going off the base. And therefore, I spent a large portion of my time in primary training at Cal Aero at Ontario, paying a penalty for my escapades by walking up and down in front of the administration building with a parachute slapping me in the butt and carrying a broomstick across my shoulder. I should have learned. That's another one of my character defects. I seem to have an impossibility for a long period of time to learn from my past experiences. But I got a great deal of pride out of walking up and down in front of that Here I am suffering with holes in my shoes and walking so damn many tours and making a terrible sight, paying off these tours. But my buddies, my timid buddies, would come by on their way to town legitimately, and they'd say, boy, you sure got a lot of guts. You got a lot of guts. And I said, you damn right, they can't do this to me. I had some early symptoms of alcoholism, too. I think they're early. I seemed to have an enormous, right off as soon as I got over the puking scene, I seemed to have an enormous capacity to drink and not have it have any great untoward effect on me. I think that's significant. I look for that. I work with alcoholics now, and I look for that. Did you have an increased tolerance early? And the way it hit me at that stage, you know, the boys that I drank with, those boys from New Jersey and various other places, they seemed to get drunk and pass out and vomit and burp and all that other crap. I'd end up taking them home, back to the base. But it never did bother me. And the next morning, I get up and go to the flight line, clear-headed, feel good. They'd make certain remarks to me like, Bill, I don't understand, or they called me Tex then, Tex, can you imagine that? I don't understand how you can even get up. We only drank half as much as you did, and we had a hell of a time standing roll call, reveille this morning. And I just beamed, you know, because I could drink so much that made me a man. I was real proud of that. That set me off separate and apart. And it certainly gave me the idea if I'd known anything about alcoholism at that time, I would have diagnosed those people that couldn't drink as maybe having a drinking problem and shouldn't be drinking in the first place. But a man that could hold his liquor like I could, problem that wasn't a damn thing wrong with. And I stayed like that for a long, long time. I walked the tours up at Merced. I walked the tours at Stockton. But I guess I flew an airplane so good that they just didn't wash me out because I did graduate. I have been in this town one time in my life before this meeting. And I would tell you about it just to lay some groundwork for my illness. Although at that time I saw this, as most of us do, as just an isolated episode of occasional overindulgence. As near as I can orient myself, because you see, I was already blacking out by that time. I had the feeling that if I could remember what had happened completely the night before, I hadn't had too good a time. So I'm a little disoriented as to exactly where I was, but I do recall being in a park with a horse and some guy with a knife riding on the back of that horse, which I notice is right across from where I'm staying up there right now. And I do recall that the shore patrol picked me up and put me in jail. And hell, I'm in the Army Air Force. Can you imagine the audacity of doing that? So I did spend a night in jail back in 1942 in Fresno. But again, that was a mistake, as were a lot of other mistakes later on. Ultimately, I got married. I did get out of the service. I decided there wasn't much profit in flying airplanes. I went on to medical school. I'm going to rapidly race over this. I drank off and on through medical school. I drank on the weekends. Don't let me minimize the fact that you don't get to be, that if you are going to be a doctor, there is a certain amount of heavy studying. And I kind of went through medical school telling myself that I can study better as long as I'm sipping on this Muscatel, but I didn't drink the hard liquor, and believe it or not, God gave me a pretty good brain, I suppose, because I graduated with no difficulty, just a lot of hard work from medical school. I became an intern, went to Miami, Florida as an intern. I didn't drink very much in Miami, Florida, because I only made $34 a month. And you can't get very much to drink on $34 a month, particularly when you're going to work at 7 o'clock one morning and getting off at 5 o'clock the following afternoon, and you do that every day for one solid year with no time off. There ain't much time to get in much trouble. But I made a mental resolve. Here I worked a whole damn year for $34 a month, taking care of this person, that person. You see, I was getting commercial by now, and I'm going to get even. And those of you who paid some doctor bills know that we do get even. Wasn't satisfied just to be an intern. I went on and took a general practice residency. I do like people, and I wanted to be a qualified doctor, so I took another year just of a residency in general practice, and I did general practice for 8 years. Started out in a small country town. That town was a dry town in Texas, and one of my first patients came in and let me know that she wanted me to change her pharmacist to another pharmacist because probably I didn't know it, but that she had called him to have a prescription filled on New Year's Eve, and when he delivered it, he had liquor on his breath. And I got a clue. So as soon as I could, and with a fairly good reputation, with no difficulty on this town, I moved to a more cosmopolitan town down on the Texas coast called Texas City, Texas, and you can't get more Texas than that. There, a classmate and I built a clinic, and I continued general practice. And that's where the disease began to catch up. I'm not indicating to you that I wasn't drinking. I was drinking during these years, but I was able to control when I drank. Within reason, I was able to control how much I drank. I was able to control, by and large, what I did and what I said while I was drinking. In other words, I was an alcoholic, but I was doing controlled drinking. But our practice down on the coast boomed. Lots of patients. Lots of patients. So many patients that in order to see them, we worked all day long. We each of us had 5 or 6 examining rooms, and I'm sure you've been to doctors. We were general practitioners. And we just kept the room full and just kept going from one to the other, and one to the other, and to the other, to the other. Had no time to write up our records. This is not a reason I became an alcoholic. This is just how I became an alcoholic. At the end of the day, I developed a habit, again, based on the way my practice was going. It really was little use for me to go home before 7 or 8 o'clock at night because there were always that certain number of patients who would call me instantly when I get home and would start out, "Dr. Gambrill, I hated to bother you while you were busy at the office today, so I waited till you got home." And at that time, I was rather resentful, and so I counterattacked by just staying at the office and writing up my records. But I was tense at the end of the day, and I recall back, I guess, from Army years, where tension was relieved by a few drinks, and now that I was making more than $34 a month, I needed a drink. I could afford a drink. I wanted a drink. It relieved my anxiety. It made me a better husband, you Al-Anons. When I got home, I wasn't near so irritable with my wife and my children as they were coming along. The tension I was able to leave at the office, and so I drank. There's another thing, though, that has to do with this tolerance. As time went on, day in and day out, that's when I became a daily drinker. And I might say, I would define that word drinking. I became a daily gulper, is a better word. I never was much, maybe this is from Texas, but I never was much to kind of hold a mixed drink with my little pinky sticking out here and sip on it. I was more like I was out in California when I came out here 18 and a half years old and I went into a bar and the guy says, "What do you want to drink?" And I says, "I want a double shot of whatever I could recall." I had to learn to drink out here. Double scotch, I guess, we'll say that. And he says, "Well, what do you want for a chaser?" And I says, "I ain't going to cuss tonight, but I says, I don't need a chaser. I'm from Texas. I'll just smoke a cigarette." So I go up and wrote my records and was a pleasant husband when I went home for a while. I was answered the phones. I occasionally delivered a baby when I was kind of had to take some Clorets or something like that. They have a habit of coming at the most inopportune times. If I had to operate, I didn't drink. I went on, did the operation, went on home, and then had some drinks. So I still was doing controlled drinking, but I was drinking every day. And over the space of several years, you know the story, a few drinks became a half pint, became a pint. And believe it or not, in just a few years, I was sitting there at that office drinking a fifth. Of course, I might have a few trusted friends drop in and help me with it, but by and large, I was able to see that most of that fifth is going down my gullet. And my wife was at home, and of course, she expected to, after having a hard day with the children, she expected to have a few drinks with me, too, when I came home with her. So I found myself in an unusual position of having to buy a bottle at noon to get me through my records until 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and then go by the same liquor store to buy another bottle to take home so my wife and I could have a few drinks together. Still, we got along pretty well at this time. She griped about my work. I griped about my work. I became angry at some of my patients, particularly the foolish calls that I received. But I didn't know how really to say no to these people. I still don't know how to say no. That's another character defect that I'm working on. But the point is, little by little, the irritability and the friction, my wife began to notice that I was a little loot when I came home. She began to make mouthing noises like, if you're going to drink, I wish you'd come home and drink. That's early in Al-Anon, by the way. But there were little things that caused me to react. And my reactions at first were mild, and then my reaction became more than mild. So ultimately, we had many, many arguments, and again, I'm speeding this up. My behavior became quite erratic. It is true that this is an iceberg disease, and although I was still functioning fine, my patients loved me. I was working 16 hours a day or more. And I would go home and tell my wife a story like this. I don't understand why you don't like me. My patients like me, and the doctors I work with like me, and my nurses, they like me. And why is it that you don't like me? I know why you don't like me. The truth has finally come out. You married me for my money a long time ago. And now that you can see that I'm a successful doctor, that you're trying to split this family up, and I'm not going to let you do it. Or, you know, arguments like that. It finally got so bad that one night I decided that I wasn't going to put up with this crap anymore. Of course, I should say, before I tell you this little story, that being so busy, I didn't have time to mess around waiting, tossing and turning 2 or 3 hours to go to sleep. And since I had a lot of medication, I had got to the point where I was kind of taking some sleeping pills and taking some booze at the same time, which probably had something to do with this. But this particular night, she had harassed me so much that I decided to teach her a lesson. And the lesson went something like this. I got drunk. That's the basis of the lesson. And I always did my drinking in my underwear at home. Anyhow, I got a gun down off the cabinet. And just to scare her, I went in there to that poor wife of mine who's not here tonight. She never comes to hear my talks. At any rate, I went in there with that gun, and she came awake with a 12-gauge shotgun pressed under. We've always argued whether it was a right or a left breast, and I don't know why that makes any difference either. But that's how she came awake, and she did the physiological thing and let out a yell. And here comes my children down the hall, at which time I put the gun in their mother's hand and told the kids that the mother was trying to kill me. Well, she sent my oldest daughter to my neighbor, who happened to be an attorney, who later I accused of messing around with my wife because he was trying to help me too much. If you ever want to get an attorney off your back, just go around town and tell him a few stories like that, and he'll quit trying to help you, I'll tell you. But anyway, as a result of this, in the aftermath of this, my wife delivered an ultimatum to me that either I was going to seek psychiatric help. I've left out some things. This was not the only thing. In other words, there were other tiny little juicy things that went along that indicated to my wife that I was crazy. And even, you know, as I look back on it, I remembered some of this, and I thought that was kind of bizarre acting, too. Another little deal that she thought was kind of bizarre was it. That I'd have patients come in and talk to me about their sex life. And hell, I didn't know anything about their sex life. I wasn't a psychiatrist. I was a general practitioner trying to make people, but the wives would come in and tell me that their husbands would or would not do this or something or another. And was that normal? Well, I didn't know whether it was normal or not, so I'd go home and try it with my wife. So there's two little things that made her think I was wacky. And you can see why she doesn't come to these talks. But I'm sober today and have been a day at a time because I finally got honest with myself. This stuff I'm telling you tonight, I kept bottled up with me. And I had a lot of psychiatry. I never told anybody this story. They were embarrassing to me. But nevertheless, they were the cancer that caused the tension that caused me to continue to drink. I saw a psychiatrist. I finally got around to telling you that I saw a psychiatrist. I didn't see the psychiatrist because I was an alcoholic. How much I drank did come up at the interview. But like all good alcoholics, I minimized the amount that I drank to the same degree that my wife exaggerated. So there's a little dishonesty on both sides there. I was depressed. My marriage was in jeopardy. I did love my family. I had a lot of trouble with my family, but I always loved them. I know it doesn't sound that way, but I always loved my family. And I was depressed over the thought of losing them. I saw myself as being a hard-working doctor who had literally pulled himself up by his bootstraps and the GI Bill and got things going pretty good and was unappreciated by a wife, was unloved by a wife, was put down by a wife. She had turned the children against me. I felt sorry for myself. And the psychiatrist, after listening to all this and other symptoms, came up with the diagnosis that, Bill, you are depressed. For which, at that time, I paid $35 an hour. He pointed out to me that though he was a friend of mine, that it would do no good for him to treat me unless he charged me. I didn't really trust him too well because his wife was a friend of my wife, and if he wasn't any more close-mouthed than I was about his patients, I wasn't about to tell this guy. But I figured he'd go straight to his wife and write straight to my wife. By the way, I just heard on this trip that his wife is now an alcoholic, so I will try to do something about it when I get home. This circle seems to come complete if you stay sober long enough. I saw the doctor off and on a weekly basis. And as near as I can gather, and those of you who have been down this road with me, as near as I can gather, the way it was coming across to me, of course, that may be the way I was presenting it. But yes, you do drink too much, and your drinking is causing a lot of difficulty between you and your wife. You drank too much. But you drank too much because you have all these problems. And your wife has a lot of problems, too. So between me and your wife's psychiatrist, and between the marriage counselors and social workers, that we're going to help you straighten out your problems, Bill. Because you're a productive man, you're a good man, you got a lot to offer to your patients, and we're going to help you straighten out your problems, and then when you don't have so many problems, then you won't drink so much. Has anybody ever heard that story? I think I was fairly honest. I believe that, by the way, being a doctor, being oriented, having a little bit of psychiatry in my background. I believe that. I believed it sincerely. I did see a definite relationship, at least I saw at that time, a definite relationship in my mind between the mountainous problems, which are really nothing more than situations that I wasn't coping with, and the amount that I drank. I did not, until I got to this fellowship here, I did not see that my drinking was causing problems. That was a new one for me that you told me. I stayed with this psychiatrist for 2 years, and we did not get divorced. So I guess he did his job. At the end of 2 years, though, he suggested that since I wasn't doing very well, that I might want to see a psychoanalyst. He based the fact that I wasn't doing very well not on what I told him, but what on my wife told him about me. And he suggested I see a psychoanalyst. I really think what he was doing was firing me, although he was too decent to say it. So he sent me out to see an analyst, and I didn't know much about analysis except that it had something to do with getting to the root of the problem. I don't know how many times the patients that I work with in alcoholism or their families, but doctor, have you got to the root of his problem? Let me tell you where the root of the problem is. It's in a bottle right here. That's the root of the problem, but I didn't see it, and so I'm kind of patient with these people that ask me the same question. Well, I went to the psychoanalyst who happened to be in Houston, which involved a 30-mile drive. And it was my afternoon off, and I used to play golf, but my golfing partner somehow or another got, you know how it is when your friends start getting too good for you? They started withdrawing from me, so I used that afternoon to go see the psychiatrist, the analyst. And I kind of had an idea what you're supposed to do in an analysis. You're supposed to lie on the couch And you're supposed to just sort of talk about anything that comes to your mind. For that, you pay $50 an hour. I did then. And he told me when I started it wouldn't do any good if I didn't go the whole 3 years, and I agreed to go the whole 3 years because, you see, as long as I'm under treatment, it looked to my wife and to my friends and those who love me that at least I was trying to do something about getting well. Now, you see, that's a cop-out, but nevertheless, that's how I saw it. So I was going to this guy, but I got the brilliant idea, since it was my evening off and I didn't have to work till the next morning. And rationalization is a great thing for an alcoholic. And I was a little tense and uptight as I tried to talk to this psychiatrist. And I knew that alcohol loosened my tongue to some degree. So I decided on the way up to see the psychiatrist that I'd stop by one of my watering holes and get me a bottle and have two or three slugs on it. And then when I could go in to see the psychiatrist, I could let it all hang out. Well, by then I was an alcoholic, and my two or three drinks would be at this town, another town, and sometimes I'd get there, I'd reel in, and I'd forget what it was I wanted to let hang out. And it would be very difficult for a psychiatrist to do any analysis when you're, you know, I was paying this guy $50 to listening to me, a drunk, rattle on, and I now do that for nothing on a 12-step call. And those kind of 12-step goals don't do any good, and I wasn't doing any good with psychiatrists, but he's getting rich, and at least I was keeping my family intact, more or less. Although, things did get so bad, Jean did have to leave me. I had an inventory taken at that time by her attorney, who came right in the middle. By then, I'm an anesthesiologist, and he came in, pulled me out of the operating room, and said that he'd been trying to get in touch with me for 4 or 5 weeks, and I wasn't cooperating, and he wanted a list of my assets and liabilities right that moment. I said, I got a case going. I don't care. I won't write this moment. So I'd have a doctor relieve me and talk to this guy. You know, authority figures have always been difficult for me to get along with, and he was an authority figure. But at least I cooperated, and we did get separated. We did get divorced, at which time, I don't know whether I loved my wife. I think I did. But right there, my mood at that time was not so much, my God, I've lost my wife. My mood was, it was a real kick to my pride that I'm not man enough to hold on to my wife, because I knew the story she was telling about me in town. They were all lies, of course, but she was telling them. So I determined to get her back, and by God, if she thought drinking was that much of an issue in our marriage, well, I was just going to quit. Wasn't that much trouble. I mean, I liked to drink, and I needed to drink, and I felt I deserved to drink. And I wasn't hurting anybody but myself. But if she wanted me to quit drinking, and if that's really what broke our marriage apart, boiled down to that, then I'd quit. Well, of course, under those circumstances, having 4 children and looking at it realistically, she relented and we got married again. That happened again, too, by the way. So you see, we in Texas are pretty stubborn. I haven't touched on physical symptoms up till now, because physical symptoms were not really, that's not the way it developed with me. I read in the Alcoholics Anonymous book that we're physically ill, and we are, but it seemed like the genesis of my illness had to do with disturbances in my social functioning, disturbances in my moral life, and reaching a spiritual bankruptcy long before I began to get physically sick. It would make sense to you that under these circumstances where you feel that you're not loved at home, and that other people do love you, that one thing being another, and biological urges being what they are, and bars being what they are, and people being what they're people, that I found someone else to love me, and that got back home, and that made things worse. And I don't think that I was ever oriented too much along the lines of being a sex maniac, although my wife would describe me as such, I think. I was lonesome. And I was hurt. Or so it seemed to me. I began going to hospitals regularly. My wife saw to that. She saw to it even when she wasn't my wife. It's difficult to practice medicine in your hometown, which is small, when the ambulance drives up pretty regularly in front of your house. And because I never did want to go, the ambulance usually is followed by the police. And if you can picture a scene, I had kind of forgotten this, but I guess repressed it. Well, Gene told Ann today about it. They come right into my house, a taxpayer, never behind on my taxes, and put me in a straitjacket and haul me off to the state psychopathic hospital 18 miles from where I practiced medicine. And I tell you, when I got out of that hospital, I was nervous because I thought my reputation might have been somewhat impaired. And it was. You see, I'm an anesthesiologist, and most of you know what that is. That's a guy that charges twice as much as the anesthetist charge. And it's kind of difficult to have you, me putting you to sleep when they say, "Doctor, didn't we read or hear somewhere or another that you were over there at John Seeley in the state psycho ward?" Or, well, how do you do about things like that? You say, "Well, yes, I was, but it was all a mistake." It was all a mistake one time. They carried me over there, and in 3 days, an alcoholic is a liar, at least I am. I speak for myself, and what I say doesn't have necessarily to mean for everybody. But I think most alcoholics are pretty good liars, pretty manipulative, pretty good con artists, pretty much of a phony. At any rate, I had in 3 days one time so successfully convinced this doctor over there there wasn't a thing wrong with me, but the trouble really was with my wife, that he committed her. That's the truth. That is the truth. I'm not lying. And where I stayed only 3 days that trip, she stayed 3 weeks. And you can imagine what I went all over town telling everybody, "Now, you see, that's what I've been living with. That's what's wrong." She's not here to defend herself. She'd tell that story a bit differently. She says she was tired and needed a rest and wanted me to know how hard it was to take care of those 4 kids. So she just stayed over there. She didn't get any therapy to hear her talk about it. She just played bridge for 3 weeks over there and then came home. And, of course, her plan didn't work because I needed to hire a babysitter. And I went on and had a big fat time trying to take care of my loneliness, if you'll understand. Sum this thing up. I'm talking about human powers. I listened, I believe it was Eleanor that read tonight, that our stories make clear to us that no human power could relieve our alcoholism. Well, I've now talked about 2 psychiatrists and 1 lawyer. Talked about a lot of doctors who tried to help me. Social workers and marriage counselors, these are all human powers. Somewhere along the line, a human power suggested that I try hand abuse. And antabuse is made by human power, and I tried that, and I'll tell you my story with antabuse. I went back. I did all right for about a month. I did terrible for about a month, but I didn't drink. And there was a party coming up, so I knew it, and I read the books, and being a doctor, I knocked it off on a Monday, getting ready for a Friday or Saturday party. And I did fine, and of course, I didn't tell my wife that. I took my antabuse every morning, and we went to the party, and I got drunk. I never meant to get drunk. I just meant to do like I used to out here in California, have a few drinks. But I got drunk, and she couldn't understand how a man on antabuse can get drunk and not get sick. And so I told her I was one of those rare people who had a strong constitution. She accompanied me to the doctor's office, who got his book down. It's in the PDR if you care to look it up. And it says in there that there will be an occasional person who will tell you that he can drink while taking antabuse. But essentially what it says is, "Doctor, don't believe him. He's a liar." And this doctor read that to me. And I'm a doctor. He accused me. He didn't actually say I was a liar, but he says the book says that you're a liar, which is about the same thing. So that human power didn't work very good. I began to have alternate periods of depression and exhilaration. I began to think something was wrong with my self-medication, which, by the way, he was giving me, some mild tranquilizer, which I had requested. But I began to think something was wrong. You see, a while ago I told you that in order to go to sleep, I took sleeping pills at night. Well, now I'm beginning to have some physical symptoms come in, like a bad case of sinus trouble and upset stomach every morning. And a bad case of what I first called hypoglycemia, until I wore that excuse out to explain my trembling hands. And after I wore that out, I decided, you know, during World War II, I got shot down by the Germans, and I had to bail out, and I pulled a delayed drop, and it popped my neck. And so after my hands quit shaking from the hypoglycemia, I worked on the basis that I had a nerve pinched in my neck, and that is causing my hands to shake. But I began to think there was something wrong with my self-medication when I found myself completely reversing the role of dexedrine, or amphetamine, as you may know it, and barbiturates in my life. When I was really working as a doctor, I would take in the dexedrine in the morning, to get a lot of energy in order to work. And I was taking a sleeping pill at night so I could go to sleep. Well, here, all of a sudden, after going to two psychiatrists for 3 or 4 years, you know what's happening now? I'm taking sleeping pills in the morning, and I'm taking dexedrine at night. And I knew that was wrong. But I had to work. I was a good doctor. I kept telling myself I was a good doctor, and it seems I could get things together enough to get the operating room going. I didn't do many of these cases myself. I was a supervisor. I had 7 nurses working for me. I had a big business going, a lot of tension. I scheduled the cases. But I had to work, or so I told myself. And the reason I had to work is because my wife was always sending me to these goddamn hospitals and putting me behind when I got out. And I had to do all the work, catch up, and then do the regular work, too. 12 times I went to hospitals. She began to think there was something wrong with me when I'd come in after one of our fights. You know, I wouldn't go home. Couldn't go home. Didn't want to go and get kicked out. She didn't like me to drink at home. Well, I won't drink at home. If I don't come home because I'm drinking, then she thinks I'm running around with somebody. It was a big mess. So, you know, you start hiding bottles here, there, and yonder around the house just so you won't offend her. You wait till she goes to bed, and then you have what's left of the bottle. This doctor finally put a diagnosis on me. You know, I began to see my Blue Cross Blue Shield bills. And the diagnosis said something like this: manic depressive psychopath. Now, you're not doctors, but I was. And I thought that a manic depressive psychopath had a grave mental and emotional illness. And that's the reason I drank. It was because I was mentally ill. And so as the police continued to arrest me, I'd say, you can't do that because I'm a mental patient. But yes, I'm drinking, but the reason I'm drinking is because I'm mental. And then they said, well, if you're mental, you need to be committed back to the hospital. But I'm not that mental, you know. My judgment was beginning to be affected. Along about that time, somewhere along the lines, I had my first convulsion. My alcoholic convulsions, I had a number of them. I never knew when I was going to convulse. We were talking last night about the people that I now treat saying, oh, doctor, I believe I'm going to have a convulsion. That's not the way alcoholic convulsions came with me. I never did know that I was going to convulse. I woke up with a load of my britches kind of walking like this, you know. My pants wet, my tongue bit, and I wouldn't know I'd had a convulsion. Somehow or another survived. My health was beginning to suffer. I never was one to ruin a good bout of drinking with eating. My liver was getting bad, but that was due to hepatitis. I still have my wife convinced of that. She was telling somebody last night that I had hepatitis. Well, you know, that's just another name for toxic hepatitis, which has to do with alcohol. Get over this in a hurry, and this doctor, after 3 years, finally decided that since I had been trying to get well through prayer and medication and not succeeding, that he thought it would be a good idea if I learned to live better electrically, as we say. And I was sick, and so I agreed to that, and I think maybe I was in the process of a divorce, or maybe my attorney was telling me it'll look good if you're getting some active treatment in the hospital because you've got 3 DWIs. And so I submitted to electroshock treatment, and it was wonderful because I couldn't remember anything. I wondered why this guy that I'd been paying all this money to hadn't shocked me years before, because I couldn't remember a single thing that was worrying me. Life was good. Of course, I didn't remember which room I was in. But that had some advantages because there was a nice girl in another room. I should say this. So, you know, God was giving me the best residency that can exist for a doctor who's trying to learn something about alcoholism is to have the disease himself. And I've treated patients since then, and I work on an alcoholic ward, and I'm amazed at the onboard romances that seem to occur on my ward. And I don't believe I would have understood them except that I went through them myself. And I wandered in this room, and I met this girl, and I was standing around this washing machine after having a bunch of shock treatment, trying to figure out, do you put your quarter in here and your shorts in here? Do you put your shorts in here and your quarter in here? And this girl who looked to me like all the movie stars rolled into one, mainly because she came up and says, "Can I help you?" And I God, that was no one had offered to help me in so long. Well, I just fell madly in love with this young lady. It turned out that her husband had kind of rejected her, and I felt that I was kind of rejected, too. And in the sense of this loneliness that somebody laughed at over there, we conducted group therapy by ourselves. And I can assure you that's not how to get sober either. It's a lot of fun trying, but you're not going to make it. I'm not against sex, but you better get some of this program under your belt before you fire some of that hanky-panky and stuff. At the stage I was in, it didn't do a bit of good. Two weak-willed people don't make one strong one, especially in this regard. And that was, this one little romantic thing that I'm telling you about was the only time that I can think of my whole 12 admissions, that I ever went voluntarily back to the hospital. About 6 months later, I heard this lady had had a relapse, and so I relapsed too. On purpose that time. But God was with me. By then, we'd gotten some of the shock treatment out of our system, and I was able to get my brain working enough to understand that she had four children, and I knew I had four, and four, and four is eight, and eight and two wives is too many, and I somehow or another was able to take care of that. And by the way, I got a letter not long ago from this lady, and I'd lost track of her. She was on my list to make amends to, and I couldn't find her after I got sober, and I did hear from her, and 2 years after I got into the fellowship, she herself went in, and she's got 2 years less sobriety than I do, and that's really great. And so she's her difficulties have worked out also. Well, human powers, shock treatment, psychiatrist, psychologist, many hospitalizations, many nurses, really making an effort to try to get well. But you see, so far all I've told you is that I'm focusing my idea of my illness was that I'm mentally ill and I'm drinking too much as a result of that. I was enough of a doctor to know that the shakes and the convulsions were due to drinking, but again, my physical constitution was so run down that I figured that was the reason for it. So naturally, I wanted to take a lot of vitamins and so forth and build myself up. And I've had another little deal that you all don't have. As long as I'm going to convulse, what's the use of taking the Dilantin after you have the convulsion? I'll just take the Dilantin and drink ahead of time, and maybe I won't have the convulsion. So the Dilantin cocktail is a 2 or 3 Dilantin tablets, and then swallow a jugger of whiskey, and maybe you won't convulse. That won't work either. If you'd like to try that out, I'll save you some time on that. Some people have a lower convulsive threshold, and some have a higher one, and I don't know what mine was, because by then, it's not I'm a drug addict so much, but I inadvertently was treating myself because I was sick and continuing to drink, thinking that because I was a doctor, I could handle all these side effects, which, of course, is ridiculous. Under those circumstances, I finally, so sick one Sunday morning, so sick, I told my wife, if this ever happens to me again, I'm going to call Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't ask me how. I think that is the grace of God, the first example of the grace of God. No one had ever told me to call AA. My wife had asked the doctor if she thought I was an alcoholic, and he says, "Miss Gamble, I don't like to pin labels on people." Well, I didn't think I was an alcoholic either, and so, but somehow or other, I decided I'm going to call AA. No one told, I never been to a meeting, no one ever told me to call them. But of course, naturally being an alcoholic, even though I swore I wasn't going to drink again, I did get that sick. And on that score, too, you know the feeling at night, those of you who can identify with me, is to swear. Swear by all that's holy to you. By now, I'm really sick. That in the morning, I'm going to finish this bottle tonight. I'm going to leave just this much left for in the morning. And I'm not going to buy another damn bottle the rest of my life. And mean it. 10 or 11 o'clock at night. 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, something happens. That little bit that you might have left for 8 o'clock in the morning or whenever, you got to have that because you can't sleep. Somehow or another built into the addictive phase of alcoholism, which is this deep sense inside of me that if I don't get a drink, something bad is going to happen. I didn't know what that something bad was, but something bad is going to happen. By then, too, I'm not staying at home anymore. I'm staying in hotels. Alcoholics fall in love a lot. I fell in love a lot. Fell in love a lot in bars. I have to tell this. I don't know all the people that I fell in love with. I I was amazed sometimes at the evidences that I could see in the room the following morning. So I was having a moral deterioration also. My children, who I dearly loved, will say things to me like, "Daddy, this weekend can we have Susie and Janet come over and have a slumber party?" I'd say, "Well, certainly. Certainly, Sharon, have them come over. But, Daddy..." "Well, but what?" "Well, Daddy, are you going to be sober this weekend? Daddy, they can't come if you're going to be drinking." I told you I ran around the house in my shorts, and I did. You know, something happened to me when I was drinking. I didn't want any clothes on for some reason. Not that I got nude, but I felt more comfortable and kind of naked. It was my house. Well, the children had made the observation that I made quite a scene, you know, running around my house with one button on my shorts buttoned up. And the neighbors weren't letting their kids come over too much. And I always had a streak of the country boy left in me, and I somehow or another preferred to use the bathroom sometimes outside the back door rather than going to the John. I had three Johns, and they weren't used all at the same time, but I wouldn't do that intentionally, but that would just happen. And so that worried my children. I did call Alcoholics Anonymous. By then, I had heard from everybody in Texas City that knew me that I was no good. I felt that I was no good, that I was sorry, that I was a degenerate, that despite my best efforts to put forward, and I was still working with my patients, and my patients thought I was a pretty good doctor. They were quite sympathetic, because I was telling them, "Look at who I'm living with out there," and they understood, "Well, God, if I had to live with somebody like that, I'd be sick too, you know." And what could she say? So the man I called, he said he was going to church. I said, "I'm Dr. Gamble. Can I have an appointment to see you?" That's how I made my 12th. That's how I called on the phone. He says, "Well, I'll see you after church." In Texas at that time, we didn't have open bars. My only source that I knew of alcohol was my lawyer's. He was a devout Catholic. I'm a Catholic, but I wasn't so devout at that time. And I'd have to wait for him to go to Mass so that on Sunday morning, this particular Sunday morning, I could go over in his back door as he went out his front door on the way to church and rob his liquor cabinet. After all, I didn't consider it robbing because look what he had done to me. I was just getting even with him. I called and I went over there, and you know this man named Sam. And Sam didn't tell me that I was no good. Sam told me, he didn't say, "I've been waiting for you." Sam sat down and he said, "My name's Sam," and very rapidly, he told me about Sam. He didn't tell me about me. He took about an hour and a half, and he told me a story about Sam. And the way it hit me was that I had thought up until that moment that I must be the only person in the state of Texas, and even my grandiose, maybe the whole world, that was in so much difficulty, because then I knew that part of my problem was not being mentally ill. At least the goodly part of my problem was that I was drinking too much, and I thought maybe Alcoholics Anonymous could teach me how to drink, and that's the truth. Thought maybe you all knew something that I didn't know, something that escaped me, and there's a doctor that you could take some medicine or maybe line your stomach with something there so to where it wouldn't make you so drunk. But he told me a story about him, and with the exception of him not having finished high school and him being a pipefitter and me having 23 years of education and being a doctor, the feelings that he was able to bring out were the same as mine. Talking about feelings, I don't know how you drink. I don't know what you drink. I don't know whether you're a beer drinker, or a hard liquor drinker, whether you're a cocktail drinker, whether you hit the sauce just full straight like I did. It doesn't matter whether you drink it daily like I did or whether you drink every now and then or so-called periodic. What I've tried to talk to you tonight about is feelings. Because the feelings of an alcoholic, to me anyhow, are pretty much the same. Whatever our preference is, when we get into difficulty, we all feel about the same. Those are the symptoms of the illness. The feelings are the symptoms of the illness, at least as I understand them. The convulsions, the DTs, the hallucinations, the delusions, those are the signs of the illness. But the feelings are the symptoms of the illness, and they're pretty constant regardless of which way that you go about it. And they are progressive, as are the signs. Sam told me that I had a disease. Now, that's something for a man that hadn't finished medical school to talk to a doctor with 23 years of education. To tell me that I had a disease... Well, I don't know anything about a disease, Sam. I've been to medical school. They never told me anything about alcoholism as being a disease. Now, they did tell me that people who drink too much get liver trouble, and they get the Jake leg, and they get neuritis here, there, and yonder. And if they're a man, they get prostatitis and might get impotent. And they have heart troubles, and they have brain troubles, and they get wet-brained, and I gave him all the complications. You see, I was in a position of telling Sam all the complications of an illness that he called a disease, and yet I didn't say it was a disease. I couldn't see that. He had a difficult time trying to get me. I didn't see it for a long time. He had a hard time with me, trying to put that point across. I even came at him, I said, well, you, the way it sounds to me like, this is a man I've called for help. Now I'm arguing with him. You ever have that happen? On a 12-step call? It looks to me like that you're no different than me, except that you haven't got as much guts. At least I'm willing to admit that I'm a drunk. And you're trying to say that instead of being a drunk, that you have a disease of drunkenness. You're trying to dignify yourself. And he says, no. He says, I have a disease. I'd like you to go to a meeting. And I said, well, where is the meeting? See, I knew more or less that that was going to be something bad because I didn't want my reputation ruined. 17 arrests and put in jail in my hometown. I didn't want my reputation ruined by going to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I told him I'd go. He'd been decent to me. He said he'd pick me up the next night. He says, you think your wife would want to go? And I said, no. Somehow or another, I had gathered from his hour and a half talk that he was likely, or somebody was likely, to tell her that she was not the cause of my drinking. I was afraid that might happen. It did happen. And so I told my wife I'm going to AA. She says, was I invited? And I said, no, you're not invited. You're not an alcoholic. I didn't want her to go. But you know, Sam had a wife. And somehow or another, behind my back, they got together. And sure enough, what I was afraid of happening did happen. And from that moment on, my wife started detached. And have you ever been detached? It took a long time. An alcoholic is going to run as long as he got somebody chasing him. An alcoholic is going to fight as long as there's somebody to fight. But when you get detached, there's nothing. Couldn't get her eyes out of her. And she stayed like that. Being divorced was better. Sam took me down to a meeting, and I went to this meeting there. And among other things I saw at the meeting was a cup full of milky water with a spoon in it, which I observed as a doctor, everybody would come by and stir their cups of whatever, coffee. And I thought, my, how unsanitary. And then I recalled having to leave the operating room from time to time. You see, I was living in my pickup most of the time at that time. And go down with my little green suit on. That's what anesthesiologists wear in Texas. And a green cap and a mask here, a white mask. And crawl down underneath. See, the police never did figure this out. I was drinking vodka. I was drinking it in Gilby's because it's a flat bottle. And I put the Gilby bottle above the spare tire which laid under the trunk of the bed of the pickup. And here I am in the parking lot at high noon, dressed like this, crawling down, inspecting my tires, trying to get that hot vodka out, shaking back to get into my pickup, looking from side to side to be sure somebody don't see me, and taking the coffee cup that's already dried out and got grounds and whatnot in it, and in the bottom pouring, or trying to pour, it's the truth, trying to pour some vodka, hot vodka, into this hot coffee cup, and as I'm pouring, I'm looking, and I see two flies swimming around down in the bottom, and I drank it anyhow. And I'm worried about a spoon over here in an AA meeting. And they called on me to talk that night, and I hope I've done better tonight. They didn't call on me first. They let me listen to a few people, and I thought, my God. You know, my God. But I felt like I had to say something. Kind of paying Sam back for his kind attention. I'd already decided halfway through the meeting that that wasn't for me and I was never going again. I was glad that he was sober, but he and I were so different that it wouldn't do me any good. But I felt I owed him something, so I got up and gave a talk about the evils of drinking as they affected the liver, the lungs, the prostate, the nervous system, anything else I could think about, strongly giving a lecture like I was a doctor lecturing to a bunch of nincompoops. To these nincompoops who knew more about drinking than I ever knew in my life. And you know, they clapped. My knowledge of AA also that night, I went home with Sam, and my wife went home, and Celia and my wife went in another room. And they gave me another deal. I'm a doctor, for God's sakes. And they start talking about medication. Well, I've got 6 years going to doctors, taking nerve medication. What right have these two lay people to tell me with my nervous condition? I've already told you I'm a manic depressive psychopath. That's something. And you need medicine for that. And they're saying, they're insinuating, they didn't say it right that way, that we in our fellowship have discovered that most of the time you don't do very well until you get off the pills. The pills, they're medicine. And the reason I got to take more is because I'm sicker than most. And Celia said, God bless her, she went into a great dissertation and assumed that I would know what she was talking, which put me in a terrible position. She flattered me that being a doctor, I certainly had heard of this treatment. And the treatment consisted of every 30 minutes ladling out a tablespoon of honey to the victim, me, and that was going to keep me from going into DTs. Now, my treatment for the DTs went something like this, as long as I had the medication. Take a lot of Dilantin, take a lot of Demerol, take a lot of morphine, and try to sleep it off. And if necessary, and if I could get the needle in, lay out my pickup in the parking lot of the hospital and hook up an IV up to the top of the pickup and let it run in my vein and hope nobody would drive by with me getting, you know, it's a peculiar place to take an IV. It's in your pickup. But that was my treatment, and her treatment is every 30 minutes to come by and give me some honey. And she said that, and he said, of course you know why that works. And I said, well, of course I know why that works. That's just like glucose. She says, no, it's better than glucose because the little bitty bees have already pre-digested it. Whatever in the crap that means, I don't. I thought that I had really flipped to even be in this type of situation. He was so serious. She was so serious. My wife was thoroughly, she just thought they were wonderful. And I, you know, there's an old saying, if you think everybody else is crazy, you better question your own sanity. And I thought they were crazy, so maybe I'm nuts, but I decided I'd go along with it. Well, they didn't start preaching right at me to begin with, but they did talk very much in Texas City about this program of recovery. You all do a wonderful thing out here. You read the fifth chapter. I had learned that by bits and pieces, although I had a wonderful sponsor, and he let me know right on that anybody could quit drinking a day at a time, an hour at a time. Asked me if I thought I could do that. You know, based on my past experience, I knew I could. And he said, that's all there is to it. Just don't take a drink today. Ask God to not let you take a drink today, and don't take a drink today. Call me. Don't take a drink today. Now, somewhere down the line, Bill, there are some steps that you're going to have to take. Well, he gave me a book. A big book. He didn't give it to me. He made me pay for it. And that gave me a 24-hour book, which I've carried since that time and still carry. And there it is. Told me also to take my money out of my left hip pocket and put it in my right, put this book here in my left hip pocket where my money was, which is a practical thing to do. So I've done that. It finally worked. Reach for your pocketbook to buy some booze. You pull out this little 12, this little book here. In a liquor store, it looks kind of funny to lay that down. And I've done that. And apologized and reached in the other pocket and got my money. He told me about this program of recovery. He told me a lot about not getting well if I took the medication. Now, I want to come across to you tonight. I don't know what medication you're taking, and I'm not a doctor, certainly under the malpractice laws of the state of California. I don't want to be practicing medicine from this podium up here. But I do believe that alcohol, minor tranquilizers, sedatives have so much in common that if you're going to try to get off one, you better give it some careful thought by trying to stay on something else. You're talking to a man that tried it. I've seen relapse after relapse where the person gets rid of off the liquid alcohol, but to get on the dry pill, which is the same. They talked to me about that. I disagreed. I didn't work the steps of the AA program. It wasn't that I didn't know them. I just wouldn't do it. Here was another authority. AA was an authority. They said, these are the steps we took. And I said, but it says they're suggested. They said, take it easy. I said, I am taking it easy. They said, well, take it. They said, easy does it. I said, I'm doing it awful easy. They said, but do it. Well, I took it easy, and I easy did it for about 2 years and didn't get sober. I did stay sober once, 17 months, 17 days. Let me tell you the embarrassing part of it. Here a man with my intelligence. Here is a man, and people are coming into the program after I come in, and they're getting sober, and here I go. I am good-looking, suave, intelligent, rich, married, divorced, remarried. All these things, and these other guys are getting well, and I'm still drinking, and they're saying at the end of the meeting, would anyone like to start over? And everybody turned around and looked at me on a regular basis. I got a lot of start over chips in Texas, Texas City. I wouldn't work the program. When she read tonight, rarely does a person fail if he thoroughly follows the path. I am a perfect example of the corollary to that, that rarely does a person succeed if he doesn't work the path, if he doesn't follow the path. I didn't follow any path. I was particularly incensed about what I regard someone invading my privacy as it referred to down in step 4 and step 5. I mean, after all, I've been 5 or 6 years carefully concealing this information from two doctors that I paid a lot of money for. And I didn't mind admitting all this to God if I'd ever get around to it, whoever he was, but I damn sure wasn't going to talk to another human being. There's a little reason for that. I hated my image of myself was so bad at that time, and I had so few friends left that I had it in my head that if I was to tell anybody what really was wrong with me, as far as these character defects that I was beginning to learn as I went to the meeting, if I really told them what was wrong with me, I wouldn't have a friend at all. So it behooved me not to say very much. I didn't get sober. They took me to a big meeting. How are we doing here? When do we have to quit? I can stop any time. They took me to a meeting, and I heard a guy from California named Chuck C. And he was good. They told me at this meeting, it was something like this, that I'd see at least 1,000 sober alcoholics. I said, bully for them, you know. I consented to go to the meeting because Chuck had come out to Shreveport, Louisiana, which at that time had bars, and somehow or another I knew that I'd get a drink. I was having a hell of a time getting a drink with the sponsor and his wife. I offered to take my car. They offered to take theirs. So I got some Valium, and I went up there to hear Chuck C. talk at this meeting. And getting ready to listen to him talk, having heard a few other talks, which I thought were pretty good, and it would have been so much better if I wasn't so damn nervous. And I needed a drink. And I had to get to the meeting, I had to walk right by a bar. So I told Sam, I said, Sam, you and Celia, excuse me, I've got to go to the restroom. Sam says, I do too. Well, I went to the restroom, squeezed out a few drops, went back, sat down. Waited 30 minutes and said, I have to go to the restroom again for something else. He said, I do too. Chuck made a good talk. I don't know what he says out here, but he said something that, just one thing I heard out of his talk. He says, instead of thinking your way into acting, start acting your way into thinking. Has anybody ever heard that? Does he still say that out here? I really didn't know what he was meaning, but I was talking about that. But all the way home, they tried to explain that to me. And he put it in the terms like, instead of rationalizing the program, start utilizing the program. The program will work if you will work the program. The program will work if you will work the program. I wish I could say that I got well. I didn't. I was eventually very sick physically, which, as I told you, came late, very late for me. And I was taken to a hospital, which is an Alcoholics Anonymous hospital. We have one in Texas. Every member on the staff is a recovered alcoholic. They have all recovered through the auspices of our fellowship. They have all, or most of all of them, have had a story where they have tried other ways to recover. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with the other parameters of treatment, and certainly probably we need them. But somewhere along the line, it seems to me like AA has got to have a major place in not only recovery, but certainly in the maintenance of our recovery once we get well. And that's the type of hospital this thing was. Being all alcoholics, they were able to dry me out as opposed to the 12 hospitals that I went to previously. When they dried you out, you were dried out. You said, I can't sleep, they'd laugh. Can you imagine that? You say, I'm nervous, they said so. I'm shaking, well. They discouraged onboard romances. From there, I learned, as others shared their story with me with a certain degree of honesty, I learned to be a bit honest with myself. This word psychopath had really worried me. Psychopath is an amoral, antisocial individual who doesn't learn from past experience and is a pathological liar. I knew from medical school that those were the four symptoms of a psychopath, and I had a lot of them. And I wondered, when it talked about incapable of being honest with ourselves, that we seem to be born that way, or those, I wonder if they were talking about a psychopath. And I asked myself some searching questions up there at this hospital when I finally got dried out. And that is the beginning of recovery, to get fully dried out. Not just get off the booze, but get really dried out enough to where your brain can heal, enough to where you can think. And I asked myself, well, you reckon I can't be honest with myself? Or is it I just won't be honest with myself? That's a question I think everybody has to ask, and the answer finally came back to me. Well, certainly I can be honest with myself. I've just gotten the habit of lying, and I know it's going to take some doing, but if my life depends on it. You see, another thing had happened. My wife had left me again, and now I'm going to get well. If I'm going to get well, I'm going to get well for myself. The last time she left, there was a certain amount of release. She had detached so well that actually I felt some freedom not having to recover to try to get her back. I assumed she was gone. At this hospital, with the help of other people who shared their story with me, I know that I didn't share mine too well with them. I probably exaggerated some stories because I had a tendency at that time, if they told one, I'd tell one better. You know, if they had one oil well, I'd have 10. If they had 10 cows, I had 100. If they had a 1,000-acre farm, I had 5,000. But allowing for those minor indiscretions, I finally got down to be reasonably honest. And, you know, they liked me. They accepted me. Part of me getting well, part of you, I think part of any alcoholic getting well, he has to come to learn to like himself a little bit. Has to learn to come to forgive himself a whole lot. He can't forgive himself if he's still resenting and not forgiving of other people. I stayed at this hospital 6 weeks. Believe it or not, at this 6 weeks, I took a pencil and a piece of paper, and I wrote an inventory. I found a man, not at this hospital, but I found a man with 23 years of sobriety who died just the other day. I asked him if he would be the person that I could talk to in the fifth step, and he says, have you written it down? And I said, yes, it's written down. He says, if you got it written down, I'll talk to you. If you don't, I don't want to listen to you. Just shoot the bull. He gave me 9 hours of his time and 9 hours of his time, so help me. And this man was not an educated doctor either. This man was an AA member. This man gave me 9 hours of a time. At the end of that 9 hours, I had done more toward understanding myself, knowing what was really wrong with me. I'd done more in that direction than I'd done with all the psychiatrists that I'd ever gone with. I had a base on which to start. I didn't know much about God at that time. This man assured me that if I would do what I could with the program and not get hung up on any particular step, but just take some steps that I could actually do and work on them, that God would come to me, because I wouldn't even be seeking him had he not already found me. And that was a relief to know that, because I had been trying for long, back when I was sick, to cry out, God, help me, where are you? I thought I had to do something to try to find him. This man was saying, tend to your business, God will tend to his. He said, we have a step in this program that says you will have a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. Seemed to me like I wanted to have the spiritual awakening and get enough power in order to do the steps. And maybe some people can, but I wasn't able to do that. I don't really know how this occurred. I did stay sober. I left this hospital. I had a list of 51 names. Somehow or another, something had changed in me. I didn't want to go home. The doctor said that if I didn't go home and clean up the wreckage of my past, that I'd be running the rest of my life. I had 51 names. I went back to Texas City, and over the next 2 years, I saw these people with the help of a sponsor asking his advice as to how to tend to this, that, or the other. I went to them one at a time, eyeball to eyeball, looked at them pensively, but nevertheless maintaining some degree of dignity, and asked them what I could do to straighten up the problems that I knew I'd caused in their life. And there were some problems that were very ticklish. I was beginning to work the program. As far as the prayer and meditation was concerned, I had the book that I had thrown away that I carry in my hip pocket. I still carry it there. I'd like to tell you, and I believe I'm pretty accurate, I don't believe I've missed more than 10 or 12 times in the last, since December the 31st, 1968, looking at it morning and many times during the day. It's not there as a good luck charm. It's there to use. I didn't understand exactly what I was reading, particularly the thought for the day. But as time goes on, I begin to make some sense out of it. I stayed sober at 7 months, my wife. Really don't know how that happened. Really, all she didn't agree to marry me again. She just agreed to have a cup of coffee with me. And as a result of that cup of coffee, we got going again. And by the way, we have something now that we never had. If I had to be sick to get it, it's worth it. We have what I consider to be a beautiful relationship. We still have areas in which are her areas and my areas in which we don't talk. But there's been an ever-broadening area in which we can relate one to the other. Our children, the greatest thing in the world. I've been given 5 years. They're all grown up and married. But the children, through the auspices of Alatine, just like my wife and Al-Anon, readily accepted the fact that their father was sick. Now, my wife and Al-Anon, she was kind of cynical about this sickness part and this disease part, but my children never had any trouble. Daddy acted like that because Daddy was sick. It was that simple to them. The faith of a little child. Wasn't that easy for me to accept, but it was really easy for my children. Daddy doesn't act like that anymore because Daddy is well. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, Alatine, and Al-Anon. At 15 months, I got depressed again. They called it a dry drunk. I don't know what it was. I had one more step to go. I had worked the mechanical steps of the program, as I've tried to tell you. One more step to go. I went back to Starlight. I wasn't drinking. I was feeling pretty bad. I asked them what was wrong, and they said, it's time to begin work on step 3. I really didn't know what that meant, but I got on it by asking God to help me. Asking Him to help me make a decision to turn my life and will over. I was willing, I suppose, but I didn't even know how to ask. As a result of that, I was 15 months of being sober. I was back in my practice. It had become financially successful again, but the message came through, and those of you who can read me, the message came through as clear as I've ever had a message that if you turn your life and will over to my care, I want you to work with alcoholics. I've been doing it ever since. I really didn't know how to do that. I didn't know how to put it into practice. But all I had to do was say yes. And having said yes, God has taken care of it, and I now find myself full-time working with alcoholics 8 hours a day full-time, and then that stretches out on my own time at night, too, and it also involves my wife. If you ask me as a doctor how this works, I couldn't tell you. I could say, well, I know the philosophy, the group therapy, the sublimation of the fact that I can't drink anymore, therefore I will run around and work with people who are drinking. The thing that makes it work, and the story that I tell to every patient that I've met to the hospital, is essentially what I've told you tonight. If he's got a wife, I tell the wife the same story. I wondered when I first went there what they would think about having an alcoholic doctor treat an alcoholic husband. I have had some rises out of that, an alcoholic doctor treating an alcoholic wife. But over a period of time, I think if you can share your story, I can share my story completely with my patients. They do seem to relate, and they do know that there is a condition, and they do know that the doctors as such are powerless to deal with this condition, but that there is a power that can take care of it. We'll try to help him find that power. What are the results? I really couldn't tell you. I have planted lots of seed. I have to be patient. I have to remember that it took Sam working with me almost 2 years before I got well. Although Sam planted the seed, Sam wasn't there to reap the harvest. I recovered at another hospital after 2 years of Sam seed planting, and I hope that maybe that happens to some of my patients. I have a home. I live out in the country now. I raise goats. I raise chickens. I don't rush around anymore. I don't pass a lot of gas anymore. I think I've calmed down some. I want to thank you again for letting me talk to you tonight. I think I made this talk without cursing, and if I did, I know I'm gotten better. God bless you.